B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comments. It's Thursday, November 5th, 2020.
Presidential elections are planned distractions to divert attention from the action behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
Like a game of chess when the house is a mess, or a petty money squabble when your marriage is in trouble, or a football game when there's rioting in the streets. It's just another movie.
The Gospel According to Tim Buck 3 opens our podcast today. And before we get to the election situation and other news and comment today, if you'll indulge me, I want to dedicate this podcast to the memory of Hillary Flynn. Hillary, a friend of more than 20 years, died early this morning after a 10-plus-year battle with cancer. And she was an inspiration to many of us who knew her and worked with her. 20 years ago, I met Hillary and through a mutual friend, Rona Renner, and Rona's husband, Mick. And the four of us helped start a nonprofit that produced radio programs for the parents of young children. And it was one of the most satisfying enterprises I've been involved with over my now lengthy lifetime. And Hillary was just a gem of a person with a fierce and strong heart who was not shy about sharing it. And she was quite determined. She had her children, Catherine and Robert, after she turned 40, and was deeply devoted to them. And the community is closing ranks to help support her children. And we are dearly and deeply going to miss Hillary Flynn. So the vote count is continuing to chug along, and Joe Biden is closing in on the 270 electoral votes needed to be named the next president. And it appears, and I'll run through the five states that are still counting votes, or counting votes that matter, in a second here, but it does appear that Biden is going to prevail at the Electoral College. And what remains to be seen is whether Trump will yield, accept reality, or if he will put up a prolonged and what appears to be useless legal battle to hold on to the presidency. And he dreams of getting in front of the U.S. Supreme Court now that he's packed it. But it's not clear that he has the traction to do so. And so, as I say in the headline to today's podcast, Biden is likely to win the Electoral College, but will he become president? And will that be decided, like it was 20 years ago, by the Republican majority on the Supreme Court? So the critical states that are still in play, we're told that Georgia may be able to declare an end to ballot counting by the end of the day. They're at 98% of estimated votes reported, and there is a mere 9,000 gap, with Donald Trump narrowly leading in Georgia. And this is pretty stunning. I never expected Georgia to come through for the Democrats, largely because of Greg Palast's deep coverage of the corrupted electoral process in the Peach State. And, of course, Trump took a pretty big lead on election night, but it has been declining ever since. And it's now an open question whether it will actually go for the Democrats. In North Carolina, this may not be resolved for a while because mail ballots are accepted up until November 12th. That's a week from today. And Trump is leading North Carolina by about 90,000 votes. So that is one that could change, but it may take time to percolate just a little bit. In Pennsylvania, they're telling us, the election officials, that they may be able to report that all absentee ballots have been counted by the end of business today. What I'm currently showing, with 93% of the estimated votes reported, is that Trump's lead has narrowed. Let me do the math here. 18 from 26. That's 70,000 votes. And as you probably know, it was scary on election night because Trump had rolled up a margin ahead of Biden of around 600,000 votes. So that one does appear to be trending toward Biden. And we've been told the specialists on TV, John King and his map over at CNN, they keep telling us that the outstanding ballots mostly are in Philadelphia and that those have been breaking largely in favor of Biden. So if Pennsylvania is announced for Biden, the game will be over because, as I said, Biden is showing 253 electoral votes and there are 20 to the winner of Pennsylvania. Then we move to the west where Arizona is only releasing the updates once per day. And Biden still enjoys a lead there, 65,000 votes roughly. That has been declining, and that has scared some Biden supporters, but it does appear to be holding pretty well for the Democrats. And then in Nevada, where Biden has been in the lead, he still enjoys a lead of about 12,000. That was only 7,000 last night, but there's still 11% of estimated ballots to be counted. And Nevada has given an indication that you shouldn't expect the current batch of ballots to be completely tabulated until late Saturday or perhaps Sunday. And like many other states, Nevada has to accept and count ballots that come in through next Tuesday. So if people are looking for an early out here, Pennsylvania or possibly Georgia could supply that. But it is interesting to see just how close this is and to see Trump sputtering. He's been reduced to just a lot of tweeting, but there have been long periods of silence as he works the phones and spends a lot of time in front of Fox News trying to figure out the best path forward. And he keeps turning to his lawyers and saying, file a lawsuit, stop the voting, keep the voting going over here, but not in Pennsylvania. And that, according to the legal commentators who I've been paying attention to, is going to produce this scattershot approach, kind of schizoid. And that's not a good basis for going to federal court up to and including the Supreme Court. So the two candidates have been duking it out on Twitter this morning. Biden put out a short video entitled Count Every Vote, while Trump went on Twitter after a 14-hour silence. Oh, my God. What do the cultists do if there's no new tweet from Trump for 14 frickin' hours? Anyway, his all-caps message was, stop the count. And of course, his aides scrambled to say, well, you know, he means count all of the votes that were legally cast either on Election Day or received on Election Day. And of course, Team Trump is trying to rewrite the rules, claiming that any vote that arrived after Election Day is somehow fraudulent. And today, Biden did pick up the official endorsement of the Associated Press in Arizona that he has won that state. That's how he got to the 253 number. And so it is a bizarre situation, where you have the MAGA hats with guns showing up in Arizona last night. I think it scared some of the people working in the elections office there. And so far, while we've seen a lot of loud voices and some people on the streets, we have not seen the order that the Proud Boys can move from standby to active. And I hope we don't see that. So the Trump campaign has already called for a recount in Wisconsin. In Michigan, which has already been called for Biden, the president's lawyers pressed on with a legal demand for the count to be suspended. And get this, the issue is that they're claiming that their representatives have not been able to be posted at each postal ballot counting table. And that seems to be a pretty trivial matter. If you hope to get ballots rejected or uncounted after they've already been counted. And in Nevada, the campaign filed a lawsuit Thursday claiming that 10,000 people who cast ballots were no longer residents there. And there's another lawsuit pending in Nevada challenging the efficacy of signature matching software, a case that the Trump camp has already lost twice. And in a moment, we're going to help you understand how some of these memes get fed, particularly the one about voters in Nevada who cast ballots even though they didn't live in the same location. And that is a fact-free assertion so far, an evidence-free assertion from the Trump campaign. In Pennsylvania, the president is asking the Supreme Court, that's the state Supreme Court, to reverse its decision, allowing the state to extend until Friday the period in which it accepts late-arriving ballots. And the attorney general in Pennsylvania said that the lawsuit was more of a political document than a legal one. A coalition of liberal activist groups are meanwhile suing the Postal Service to force it to sweep sorting offices in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, pointing to data suggesting that there were as many as 8,000 undelivered in Pennsylvania alone. Yesterday, we heard the number of 300,000 ballots that hadn't been delivered, and from what I've seen reported, about half of those have been accounted for. That still leaves the other half that we're not certain of. So, in Pennsylvania, the top election official said she expected the overwhelming majority of the outstanding 550,000 votes to be tallied by the end of the day on Thursday, and that a state winner definitely could be announced by the end of this day. And as I mentioned, that could tip it in the favor of Biden and leave Trump just kind of gasping. I think he's already gasping, but we will have to see just how long he attempts to continue to fight and how many people support him. Because most of the Republican people who rode back into office, only one incumbent senator was booted out. No incumbent Republicans of the House lost their races. So this is an endorsement by half of the country, saying that the Republicans did a bang-up job in the last 4 years. Who cares if they broke the Constitution over impeachment? Who cares if they overlooked the daily corruption of Trump? Nobody cares. And that, of course, is what drives me to a level of despair that I described to you yesterday. So, I don't think I mentioned this one. A Superior Court judge dismissed a lawsuit today filed by the Trump campaign accusing election officials in Chatham County, Georgia, of mishandling absentee ballots. So they are grasping at straws. They are looking for ways to prove the voter fraud or irregularities that they have been fantasizing about literally for months. And so this leaves them with little to do except bloviate on Fox News. So here's the report on the Republican reaction. The Republican leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, from here in California, he sidestepped questions about whether he agreed with Trump that election officials should stop counting votes. And he interpreted this for us. What the president wants to make sure is that every legal vote is counted, McCarthy told reporters, that people vote up until Election Day, not the days after, as others would have. Now, there is no indication that anybody has tried to vote after Election Day. That is a pure straw man created by Trump and his allies. And here's one Republican who's not standing for it. Adam Kinzinger, who is from Illinois, responded to the president's middle-of-the-night claim Wednesday morning. "Stop. Full stop," he wrote. "The votes will be counted and you will either win or lose. And America will accept that. Patience is a virtue." There are armies of well-funded Trump and Republican allies who are out there scouring the country trying to find instances of alleged voter fraud that they can use to magnify and make the claim that there is massive fraud being conducted in this election. So you may have heard of Jimmy O'Keefe. James O'Keefe runs what he calls Project Veritas. He's very well-funded by wealthy right-wingers, and he produces deceptive videos. That's his game. He's the one who was convicted of violating California law when a hidden camera was used to trick Planned Parenthood executives into making damaging comments about abortion issues. And so he's back. And this video is mostly set in Las Vegas, where a hidden camera captures a postal worker who is claiming that there are ballots just lying around all over the place. Take a listen.
"Yeah, where can I find a handful of them?"
"I don't know, man. Hey, I'm almost finished with the boxes today."
"All right, brother.
Hey, not a problem, man. I'm going to see if I can get you some, like a little nice little handful."
"Oh, what's your unit number? You're going to get a handful?
What's your unit number?"
"322. You're going to get a handful?"
"I'll probably put a, I don't know, maybe. If it's in there, I ain't do it."
"And you'll put some in there for me?"
"I might, man.
All right, brother.
See what I can do."
A postal worker in Nevada offered our undercover journalist a handful of ballots that was sent to the wrong address.
So, this is James O'Keefe narrating after a clip of this hidden camera video was shown. And you hear the postal worker clearly saying, "Maybe, I might, maybe I can do this." And O'Keefe turns it into a promise. And he turns it into a set of facts. Now, in Nevada, the legislature enabled a statewide vote-by-mail effort this year. And they did indeed mail ballot applications to every registered voter in the state. And even if they had mailed out actual ballots, the only way they count is if when they are received at the election office, if they match the indicators of a registered voter. And this is in promotion of a meme that so far we've seen no evidence for, that there are as many as 10,000 people in Las Vegas who moved since earlier this year. And yet their ballots were mailed out to them at the address that they were linked to. Now, you're allowed to move within the confines of a county without losing your vote or being required to re-register. At least that's my understanding of the law in most states. And so this is James O'Keefe trying to gin up and to feed the fertile minds, such as they are, of Trump's cult into believing that this is a serious problem, and you can ask any mailman, and he'll be able to tell you that there are just all these extra ballots lying around. So there's an interesting piece. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. It's under the byline of Julia Carey Wong at The Guardian today. And she interviews Whitney Phillips, a professor of communications at Syracuse University, about the way that Trump, since April, has been laying the groundwork for these claims of vote-by-mail fraud by questioning the legitimacy of mail-in ballots and promoting the vague conspiracy theories about fraudulent ballots that he's tweeted wildly about, including yesterday. "Trump's claims," she writes, "are perfectly suited to people who share what Whitney Phillips, the professor, describes as deep mimetic frames or deeply viscerally held stories about the world that shape what you think to be true and what you think should be done in response. One such frame is characterized by deep distrust of institutions and a general sense that there are people who are out to get people who look like us. Oh, like the deep state. This mindset has been prevalent in recent months amid the rise of QAnon and COVID skeptic communities, says Phillips. In some ways, the sensationalist child-eating, blood-drinking QAnon stuff distracts from the really corrosive part of the narrative, which is the idea that liberals, scientists, and Jews are all coming to get you, so you better go get your guns. Phillips views Trump's failure to debunk or denounce conspiracy theories as preparations for selling this latest one. In the past few months, Trump started using the deep state by name. He started specifically engaging with and embracing QAnon, she said. That underlying frame, don't trust them, was the groundwork for his efforts to contest the election. Later in the article, quoting again, under intense pressure from the traditional news media, researchers, and civil society, the social media platforms that long allowed Trump tremendous leeway to break their policies have taken a more aggressive stance. Well, a little. In the run-up to the election, Twitter and Facebook began applying misinformation labels to some of Trump's false statements. And the article continues, the labels are by no means a panacea. For people behind a certain frame, a label on a tweet is just more evidence that they're censorship. They seem to enjoy being punished and being victims. It's part of their brand now. So I think that's interesting commentary, and I think it supports what I'm arguing here, that James O'Keefe is part of this orchestrated effort. And there's even more evidence of it. This is the most fascinating article I read today. It's under the byline of Emily Dreyfus at the New York Times. And Dreyfus is a journalist who is currently at Harvard's Center for Technology and Social Change. So Dreyfus broke down some of Trump's Twitter activity. And a recent tweet where he used the hashtag with an intentional, she believes, misspelling of pound sign or hashtag Biden crime family. And the word family is spelled intentionally, she says, with two I's. That's because Twitter has been basically censoring those that have a hashtag where the word family in Biden crime family is spelled properly. So Dreyfus writes, Biden crime family and the typo is a crash course in how to rally supporters around a conspiracy theory. Trump has used this same tactic to sow doubt about mail-in ballots and the integrity of the election. The hashtag took a complicated issue with legitimate questions about Hunter Biden's business dealings with Ukraine and China. Now, this is fascinating alone that the New York Times published the lines that I just quoted because they do not acknowledge as legitimate the questions about Hunter Biden's business activities. Anyway, let me continue. And reduced it to a slogan that could also be used to spread falsehoods about Joe Biden. Constant repetition makes the charge sound true and blunts accusations of unethical behavior against Trump and his own family. And that, of course, is one of the things that I find fascinating, the reverse projection. That Trump, who presides over a criminal family enterprise, you know, like a mob family, he is so comfortable in demonizing Joe Biden. And as you know, I do not say that Joe Biden or Hunter Biden are innocent. I think at minimum they've engaged in the appearance of conflicts of interest that they should have fessed up about. And I don't think that it's all at the minimum level. At any rate, the article continues, and Trump's typo, the two I's in family, it was surely not accidental. That extra I circumvented Twitter's efforts to hide the hashtag in search results. It's called typo squatting. This tactic is used by trolls and media manipulators to get around the rules of social media platforms. Now, I am free to admit to you that I did not know that. So, Dreyfus then goes into the origins of this. We see Chanel Ryan, I think that's how she pronounces her name. She's the info babe over at the One America News Network. She traveled to Ukraine with Rudy Giuliani to capture dirt. And she uses the Biden crime family hashtag. But this tweet is a couple of weeks old, and so family is spelled properly. Next, seeding on social media. In any manipulation campaign, the second stage involves campaign operators strategically spreading the hashtag across the media ecosystem. In this case, it serves two purposes. It made the phrase itself more common, and it amplified the New York Post's Hunter Biden laptop report. In early October, Giuliani used the hashtag repeatedly, hinting at what would later be revealed by the Post about Hunter Biden. And on October 7th, Rudy's tweet properly spelled family in Biden crime family. Then Steve Bannon enters the picture, and he is using the same Biden crime family language. Then Giuliani echoes that on October the 14th. Then on the 16th, at a mob rally in Florida, Trump refers to the Bidens as a crime family three times. The hashtag seeded itself on alternative social networking sites, popular on the right-wing chat site called Parler. By this past Monday, there were 21,000 parleys or posts using the term Biden crime family. The effort became more urgent when Twitter took the rare step that day of blocking those posts to the New York Post article. And one of the people retweeting this was G News. That is the site owned by the billionaire Guo Wengui, who is a big pal of Steve Bannon. Bannon was on the yacht of Guo when he was arrested by federal authorities for his border wall scam. And in the past 2 weeks, G News published and pushed salacious conspiracy theories about Hunter Biden, and Twitter accounts with the word Himalaya in the handle used the Biden crime family hashtag to spread those photos across Twitter. Many of these accounts are now suspended. On October 16, the Daily Beast reported that these Himalaya accounts were a connected network affiliated with Steve Bannon. Then stage three is the amplification by media people. And we learn the term hidden virality, meaning that something extremely popular in one part of the internet is going unnoticed by the mainstream news media and the rest of us. And this is what I've been sounding the alarm about recently, that there's a whole dialogue against Hunter Biden that is thriving on the right, and because it's been suppressed by the corporate media, well, there are plenty of people who are completely oblivious to it. And that's not the only issue where that happens. So I think this is a fascinating story. I haven't described it all completely here, but I've linked to it. And I encourage you, if you have a spare moment, to follow that link to the New York Times and check it out. So Kayleigh McEnany is Trump's latest press secretary. And she is trying her darndest to channel what her boss wants her to say. And, of course, it's difficult because he offers contradictory statements. So today, he once again tweeted, any vote that came in after Election Day will not be counted. So McEnany went on the friendly Fox News channel Wednesday night with Brett Baier and Martha McCallum. And despite the friendly scene there, McCallum was pretty persistent with McEnany. So in McEnany's comments, she's saying that she wants to stop the vote in Pennsylvania because they want to extend arrival for 3 days after for ballots. McCallum said, well, even if the person voted on voting day, even if they voted on November 3rd in Pennsylvania because they were told that that was okay to do, you're going to toss their ballot out if it doesn't come in until the day after or 2 days after? McEnany said, well, no, we believe every vote on Election Day should be counted, but it's those that arrive after Election Day that we are fighting. McCallum continues to press, even if they already voted on November 3rd, which is the postmark? McEnany deflects the question by saying, "We want Election Day ballots to be counted, and we will prevail." And at the beginning of the exchange, Baer had asked McEnany whether there's any real evidence that anything untoward has actually happened in the elections, and McEnany provided nothing, instead referring to things that had happened in past elections. So it's fascinating to see them try to dance to Trump's tune. And it's some kind of a polka that youngsters like Kayleigh McEnany haven't learned yet. The Oracle of Burlington, Vermont. Bernie Sanders was on the Jimmy Fallon Late Night Show on October 23rd when Fallon asked him, hey, what's going to happen here? Bernie said, well, in-person ballots cast in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin will initially favor Trump, but the early lead won't last too long, Sanders warned. Once election officials begin counting late-arriving ballots, Joe Biden will rise. And then Sanders said Trump would go on TV to falsely proclaim himself the winner. Quote, he says, thank you, Americans, for reelecting me. It's all over. Have a good day. So less than 2 weeks later, as many of Sanders' guesses have played out in real time, a clip of his predictions on Fallon's show went viral on the Twitter, where one video has gotten 29 million views as of earlier today. And Sanders spent most of the 7-minute interview raising his top concern: the large numbers of mail-in ballots would prematurely skew results in states where counting was not allowed until on Election Day or after. And when those ballots began to show Biden winning, Sanders warned Trump would claim fraud. A quote from the burn, at which point Trump says, see, I told you the whole thing was fraudulent. I told you those mail-in ballots were crooked, and we're not going to leave office. So credit to Bernie for predicting this sequence of events. Over at the Daily Poster, that's David Sirota's new outlet. Andrew Perez, who was a guest on this podcast a couple of months ago, and Julia Rock note that it was Chuck Schumer who handpicked the Democratic challengers to try to conduct the blue wave sweep of the Senate that fizzled out. And so far, the Democrats have spent more than $1.1 billion, and they flipped two seats: Hickenlooper over Gardner in Colorado, and Kelly over, what's her name, Sinema? Is that Sinema? No. Martha McSally in Arizona. And we have a case of incumbent Democrat Gary Peters in Michigan, who has been declared the winner, but his Republican opponent John James is not willing to concede so far. So the combination of Sarah Gideon in Maine, who lost to Susan Collins, and Governor Steve Bullock in Montana, who lost to Steve Daines, the two of them spent a combined $110 million. Gideon alone raised $68 million. Now, not only are those obscene amounts of money, and Bernie showed that you can use small contributions and conduct essentially an internet-based campaign and be competitive, but money is not the only thing that changes elections. We're going to get to some solid commentary here in a few minutes that I think helps flesh out that point of view. So both of the Georgia Senate races are likely to go into a runoff. David Perdue, the incumbent who is challenged by John Ossoff, well, Perdue has performed at just under 50%, and Ossoff is just under 48%. And if Perdue remains under 50 in the certified count, there will be a runoff between the two of them in January. And the other Senate seat will feature a January runoff between Republican Kelly Loeffler, who is this, I guess her husband runs the New York Stock Exchange, so she's an oligarch, And I'm surprised that she lost to Doug Collins, who is a real barnyard dog kind of guy. Anyway, the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, one of the pastors at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, is the opponent of Loeffler in that runoff in December. I'm sorry, in January. And so this could leave the balance of power and the determination of who will be the majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer, to be resolved by those two races. And this is a very unusual situation, but it just shows how we were divided in 2016. The Democrats made some gains in the House in 2018. But at this point, we are split right down the middle. And that is the total recipe for gridlock. And the only way around that is if the Democrats do pull off rabbits in both hats in Georgia, which would leave Mitch McConnell as the minority leader and elevate Chuck Schumer. That would put the Democrats in control of committees. But it is not a panacea, because so many activities, actions in the Senate require 60 votes. And the Republicans could do what they did in 2008. Actually, the meeting was on January 20th of 2009, when they all agreed to do everything possible to make Barack Obama a one-term president by obstructing everything he wants to do. And of course, Joe Biden's instinct, should he prevail, is to work across the aisle. And I hope he doesn't squander the kind of time and resources that Obama did in early 2009, desperate to put together a cabinet of rivals, including one or two Republicans. It was a total waste of time. And until the climate changes and you've got some evidence that Republicans are willing to operate in a bipartisan manner, it's absolutely insane to try to cuddle up with Republicans at this particular juncture. And meanwhile, over in the House, so far in the confirmed elections, the Republicans have flipped 8 seats for a gain of plus 6 on a net basis. And there are still races to be decided. And I took a look at Southern California, where there were 5 Republican seats flipped Democrat in 2018. And some of those people are struggling, like Gil Cisneros, who is running a close race but is 1,000 votes behind his Republican challenger, Young Kim. And then Harley Ruda. He's the guy who was a Republican until minutes before he registered as a Democrat to run in that seat in Orange County along the coast. And Ruda is roughly 2,000 votes behind his Republican challenger, Michelle Steele. Also in the Central Valley, T.J. Cox, who had picked up the seat at the expense of Republican David Valadao. Well, Valadao is back with a vengeance and is running almost precisely 3,000 votes against T.J. Cox, who is the one-term incumbent. Slightly better news over in Santa Clarita. That is at the north end of Los Angeles County, near the Grapevine, if you know what that is. Christy Smith, the Democrat, is trying to regain the seat from Republican Mike Garcia, who picked it up in a special election last summer because the woman who had served there resigned over a sex scandal. So Christy Smith is 3,000 votes ahead of Mike Garcia. And I believe about 85% of those votes have been counted so far. Interesting note today from BuzzFeed about what's been going on at Facebook over the past few days. You may know that when you watch a video on Facebook, when it ends, you're on a page where another video just pops right up. It's a copycat of YouTube. Well, those suggested videos, according to inside sources at Facebook, have included content that doesn't that is supposed to be blocked from distribution on Facebook right now. So somebody was watching, and the next video that came up was Left Plans Coup, Revolution, November 3rd, 2020, ? So in Facebook terminology, it's called the second result. So the worker sent a message to his boss, the second result in Watch Live is a non-verified page pushing election conspiracy theories. Why do we allow non-verified live videos about elections if we don't have a way to check the content and make sure it's not misinformation? So a product manager eventually removed that video after it was seen by as many as 110,000 people. And Facebook has spent months telling the public and its own employees that it's better prepared than it was in 2016 when Russia was blamed for all those Macedonian videos, the clickbait stuff that infiltrated Facebook and other platforms. So this problem continues at YouTube as well, where you watch one video and the next video that comes up. For example, when I played the video from Project Veritas and Jimmy O'Keefe, well, when it ended, the next video that came up was a clip of Tucker Carlson interviewing Tony Babaluski. So these are algorithms that are intended just to get you to keep watching, but they are so biased in favor of the biases that they've identified on the part of users like us, that they wouldn't feed, you know, if you're watching a Project Veritas video, they're not going to serve you up something about Nancy Pelosi or the heartfelt victory speech by Cori Bush that I'm going to share with you in a minute or two here. No, if you watch something on the right, they serve you up something that's even further to the right. Also, an interesting probing piece in today's New York Times about the abject failure of the polls once again. And I'm not patting myself on the back here. It's not like I'm the only one who had this criticism. But the polls do not capture the voter suppression tactics. And the polls also couldn't gauge the very high turnout from supporters of both candidates in this highly contentious presidential race. So the Times writes, it is already clear that the polling industry failed to fully account for the missteps that led it to underestimate Trump's support 4 years ago. It raises the question of whether the polling industry, which has become a national fixation, can survive yet another crisis of confidence. So they quote Christopher Borick, director of polling at Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania. I want to see all the results in. I want to see where those deviations are from pre-election polls and final margins. In some states where polls had projected Trump losing narrowly, like Ohio, Iowa, and Florida, well, he won by comfortable margins. And in states that had seemed more likely to go for Biden, like Michigan and Nevada, the result was very, very close, and Nevada is still unresolved. Then they quote Patrick Murray, polling director at Monmouth University, who says it's possible that Republican efforts to prevent certain populations from voting. That's a euphemism for voter suppression. We need to know how many votes were rejected, he said. I won't know until somebody actually gives me some data what happened. And it's possible we will never know. We will never know how many ballots were not delivered by the post office, he noted. So this is a thorny issue. And as Trump repeatedly rejected the polls, well, turns out he had a point. And what is it that Trump knows that the professional pollsters don't? Is it that people are shy about telling a pollster that they support Trump? I would think most people are over that. I think it was a factor in 2016. But there's also a new service called VoteCast, and that uses an online panel that is assembled for the Associated Press by a research group at the University of Chicago. by looking at the divergence between exit poll numbers and the responses of the vote cast canvas. They say there are far more voters who consider the coronavirus a big deal issue in their lives as opposed to people who said it was the issue that they were voting on. The VoteCast survey found that upward of 4 in 10 voters said the pandemic was their number one issue. But in the exit polls, when asked which issue had biggest impact on their voting decision, respondents were less than half as likely to say it was the pandemic. So, in any event, I think that it does vindicate the skepticism that I offered about the validity of polls here in 2020. So as I teased a moment ago, Cori Bush, African-American single mom from Missouri, won election to Congress on Tuesday night. Let me give you some extended quotes here from her victory speech. "I was running. I was that person running for my life across a parking lot, running from an abuser. I remember hearing bullets whiz past my head, and at that moment I wondered, how do I make it out of this life? I was uninsured. I've been that uninsured person, hoping my health care provider wouldn't embarrass me by asking if I had insurance. I wondered, how will I bear it? I was a single parent. I've been that single parent struggling paycheck to paycheck, sitting outside the payday loan office, wondering, how much more will I have to sacrifice? I was that COVID patient. I've been that COVID patient gasping for breath, wondering, how long will it be until I can breathe freely again? I'm still that same person," Cori Bush continued. "I'm proud to stand before you today knowing it was this person with these experiences that moved the voters of St. Louis to do something historic. St. Louis, my city, my home, my community. We have been surviving and grinding and just scraping by for so long. And now this is our moment to finally start living and growing and thriving. So as the first black woman, nurse, and single mother to have the honor to represent Missouri in the United States Congress, let me just say this. To the black women, the black girls, the nurses, the single mothers, the essential workers, this is our moment." She continued, "For years, we've lived under leadership that shut us out of our own government. For years, we've been left out in the cold, protesting in the streets, sleeping in our cars or tents, working 3 part-time jobs just to pay the bills. And today, we, all of us, are headed to Congress. St. Louis strong. My message today is to every black, brown, immigrant, queer, and trans person, and to every person locked out of opportunities to thrive because of oppressive systems. I'm here to serve you. To every person who knows what it's like to give a loved one that just make it home safely baby talk, I love you." And she went through a litany of people who she loves. Unhoused people, the family that's lost someone to gun violence, every person who's lost a job, a home, or health care, or hope. And she closed by saying, "Everything I do begins with those who have the least, who've suffered the worst, and who have the greatest to offer. Why? Because I myself have lived paycheck to paycheck. I struggled for years under the burden of student debt. I've been evicted by landlords. I've worried about how I was going to put food on the table for my 2 kids. I've been underinsured and uninsured. And for every one of those stories that I can tell you about my life, I know there are thousands more in our community. And those are the stories that I'm carrying with me and will uplift in the people's house as your congresswoman." Wow. That is really touching. Every day I pause and thank people who've supported my podcast over the years as I get ready to ease into retirement whenever this national election mess is resolved. I want to thank Joey Perillo in Philly. We've engaged in some great correspondence over the years. Also, Angela Vargas, Paul Tomaselli, and the incredible Faith Peoples. And Faith has had multiple subscriptions for a long time, and she's also contributed a lot of great comments and links and articles that have been helpful to me in producing this podcast every day. And I really value each of you who takes the trouble to download this podcast and listen, and then to often react with thoughtful comments and interesting articles. We've built a community here that I truly value. And I'm grateful for everyone who joined in. And one of those people is Linda Lewis. She's been helping me every day with the COVID-19 update, and she had to take a couple of days off this week because her computer crashed, but she took an old one out of the garage and fired it up today and has come through for me once again. But she shared this comment about my remarks yesterday. She said, "I thought you did a great job covering the election, perhaps because I had a similar reaction, dismay at the missed opportunities and the direction of the country." It's interesting, Linda says, that Trump claimed fraud was involved in states where he initially had a large lead and Biden quickly caught up. Because I observed the opposite. In states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Biden originally had enormous leads and Trump very quickly caught up. This seems like another case of Trump projection. If so, it suggests Trump knew of operations to manipulate results in those states to benefit him. I think that is a credible speculation, Linda. She continues, "I think the next 2 years will be crucial. If Biden becomes president, he will need to work hard to increase working class support and win a Democratic majority in the Senate in 2 years. If he does, Democrats would have to do something constructive with that power. And if they don't, we'll end up with Trump again or someone worse in 2024. If Trump holds on to the presidency, I anticipate he will be even more abusive over the next 4 years, increasing attacks on anyone who isn't a supporter and further undermining critical support systems like public health." And her final lines here, "I think it would be wise to use the next 2 years to make preparations to migrate to another country in the event nothing improves. I'm not anxious to leave the U.S., my ancestors helped create this country, fighting in the revolution and every war since. But I can see the fascism on the wall. I will be looking at countries with a low cost of living, openness to U.S. retirees, stable government, decent public health policies, and a supportive American expat community." I don't blame you. And here's a note from Irene in southern Wisconsin. She said, "I really liked your podcast yesterday. I'm heartbroken by how many people voted for Trump. I was a poll observer in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and it was humanizing. A bad combination of poverty, insecurity, racism, and lies. Everyone was Midwest nice. There were no issues despite the Donald's visit there the night before and a call to be ready for radical left looters. His 2016 win was clearly not an aberration or the result of interference, as you've been saying all along." She adds, "Georgia's giving me hope." Back to Kenosha, in a second comment, she said, "I think there was high Democratic turnout because of Jacob Blake. Kenosha came out 50.4% for Trump. I'd have to check the numbers, but that was lower than the surrounding counties." And this from Paul Leto in Seattle. He says, "As of today, all Biden has to do is hold on to his existing leads in Arizona and Nevada. He's got 270 and wins. The ballots counted after the election are more Democratic than Republican. So Biden has won by Democratic means, in my opinion, with a high degree of confidence. But Biden winning 270 is not enough to make him president. Trump can stop the counts or succeed by various undemocratic means in canceling election results, or just use force like refusing to leave office or declaring a martial law dictatorship. My predictive theory has been to ask the question, what would maximize the division? Maximum division, Paul says, is achieved when Dems can form a rational democracy belief that they won and some undemocratic means intervenes. I still predict the undemocratic means to rob the Democrats because it would take that to get Democrats fighting mad. It doesn't take much to get Republicans fighting mad. So this is headed towards civil unrest or civil war unless you can explain to me how Trump will relinquish power. Trump's always been fighting mad, but now Democrats will be fighting mad also. And I can't explain whether Trump will leave office, Paul. And in a parenthetic note at the end, he says, "This is why Biden will pardon Trump if he takes office. The art of the deal." I can't dismiss that. Biden does have this reflexive effort at bipartisanship. He did say during the primaries that he wouldn't pardon Trump. And I think even if he does, it would only be for federal criminal liability. And there's enough going on in the state of New York that I don't think Trump would get off scot-free. And I have a comment. What was up with Kanye West? I still have no idea why he ran for president. He was on the ballot as a presidential candidate in 10 states. Here in California, he ran as a vice presidential candidate, and nobody knows why. He made very few campaign appearances. He didn't qualify for the debates. I don't know. And if anybody can explain the Kanye concept in this presidential election, I'd love to hear it. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com. Now I want to recommend some professional commentary, starting with Chris Hedges, published both at Sheer Post, I almost said Truthdig, but that's gone, and at Consortium News today, headlined Chris Hedges, American Requiem. May I quote? Well, it's not over. Not the election. The capitalist democracy. However biased it was toward the interests of the rich and however hostile it was to the poor and minorities, the capitalist democracy at least offered the possibility of incremental and piecemeal reform. Now it is a corpse. And it's an elaborate and empty reality show funded by the ruling oligarchs. $1.5 billion for the Biden campaign, $1.5 billion for the Trump campaign, to make us think there are choices. There are not. The empty jousting between a bloviating Trump and a verbally impaired Biden is designed to mask the truth. The oligarchs always win. The people always lose. And it doesn't matter who sits in the White House. America is a failed state. And Hedges continues, there were many actors that killed America's open society, corporate oligarchs who bought the electoral process, the courts, and the media, and whose lobbyists write the legislation to impoverish us and allow them to accumulate obscene amounts of wealth and unchecked power. The militarists and war industry that drained the national treasury to mount futile and endless wars that have squandered some $7 trillion and turned us into an international pariah. The CEOs raking in bonuses and comp packages in the tens of millions of dollars that shipped jobs overseas, left our cities in ruins and our workers in misery and despair, without a sustainable income or hope for the future. Oh, and he's got more. The fossil fuel industry that made war on science and chose profits over the looming extinction of the human species. The press that turned news into mindless entertainment and partisan cheerleading. The intellectuals who retreated into the universities to preach the moral absolutism of identity politics and multiculturalism while turning their backs on the economic warfare being waged on the working class and unrelenting assault on civil liberties. And, of course, the feckless and hypocritical liberal class that does nothing but talk. If that interests you, follow the link in the show file at peterbcollins.com. Chris Hedges is a remarkable man, and he has served up this deep critique of capitalist America for many years now. Then we turn to Nathan Robinson, writing at The Guardian today, and he says that it's not the fault of the voters. It is a failure of leadership in the Democratic Party. He writes, Trump didn't run a good campaign. He botched the first debate, squandered his campaign cash. His messaging against Biden was unfocused, often incoherent, simultaneously trying to paint him as a radical Antifa-sympathizing socialist and a corrupt corporate establishment figure. At a time when the economy was voters' number one issue, Trump was focused on the emails of Biden's ne'er-do-well son, Hunter. But Biden didn't offer a clear and compelling alternative. He was a weak candidate from the start, so much so that even some of his allies were worried what would happen if he won the primary. Biden, like Hillary Clinton before him, represented the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. He loudly defended the private health insurance industry and the fracking industry from attacks by the left. He ran away from proposals favored by the Democratic base, like Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. He didn't show much interest in courting core constituencies like Latino voters, which helps explain the losses in Texas and Florida. Biden didn't even put much energy into the campaign. At crucial moments when Trump's team were knocking on a million doors a week, Biden's was reportedly knocking on zero. His ground game in important swing states like Michigan was invisible. Robinson continues, 2016 proved once and for all that the Democratic establishment simply doesn't have a message that can effectively counter Trump. The party leadership ignored the lessons that should have been learned from 4 years ago. Instead, Democratic strategy is the very definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Blaming the voters, says Nathan Robinson, simply will not do. This is a failure of leadership. Those responsible for it need to be held accountable. Unfortunately, it looks like some in the party will learn the wrong lessons. Even though dozens of Democratic socialists won their elections this year while centrists struggled, there is a contingent among Democrats whose solution to any problem is the same. Become more like Republicans. The final quote from Robinson, it is time for a whole new approach, not a double dose of the existing one. We need to take the right lessons from this election, the ones that didn't take from 16. First, don't trust polls. Don't get complacent or assume the tides of history will carry you to victory. Second, Trumpism will not self-destruct. You can't simply run against Trump. You need a powerful alternative vision that actually gives people what they say they want and fights for something worth believing in. I think that is a well-positioned screed. And one more. And Linda Lewis sent this to me this afternoon. Thank you. This is from Counterpunch under the byline of whistleblower Matthew Ho. And he calls for the creation of a new party. He gives a similar landscape as you just heard from Hedges and from Robinson. And he says, I don't think Trump will try to stay in office if he loses. He'll, of course, make a fuss and cry fraud and wrongdoing. But he says this leaves an opening on the left for a party that represents workers, the climate, and equitable society. Democratic Socialists of America's notion of a dirty break from the Democrats, where internal pressure from the left inside the Democratic Party eventually leads to a shift in values and actions, it has no antecedent in history that he can think of and means only continuing hoping the Democratic Party will break from its moneyed interests, which it never will. The target for this left party is the 25 million-plus progressive voters who vote democratically, the tens of millions of Republican voters who are looking for economic support and a chance to have what their parents and grandparents had, and others. So he says, regardless of the outcome, Green Socialists, DSA, need to organize together in order to stand alone in 2024 to finally represent the values and interests of people and planet. And he says, even if such an organization ultimately only forces the Democratic Party to the left, it will be worth it. Here's today's COVID-19 update. And the numbers keep climbing. Yesterday, we set another new record of almost 108,000 cases, new cases reported in the United States. And the death toll jumped up to 1,616 reported yesterday. And it appears that this trend will continue as we face the second wave, and Europe is struggling in the same manner. Right now in 18 states, they are reporting record numbers of patients hospitalized and a real strain on intensive care units in many parts of the country. And in New Jersey, I'm happy to hear that more than 2,200 inmates were freed from prisons yesterday, the first day of a new state law allowing some prisoners with up to 8 months left on their sentences to be released. And a court order is putting pressure on the administration at San Quentin, just a half mile from me, to reduce the prison population by 50%. While we're talking about figures, in the month of October, more than 853,000 children tested positive for COVID-19, and that's the entire pandemic number, but it was 200,000 new cases during October alone. And while children don't seem to be affected as much as more vulnerable populations, They are vectors of infections for elders, and there are some cases where it has produced fatalities. So we have more data for you here. North Dakota is reporting 157.8 cases in the last 7 days. That's per 100,000 people. In South Dakota, the number is slightly lower at 131.6. And the New York Times reports that these new record numbers are a very serious concern. No signs of receding. Five states, Colorado, Indiana, Maine, Minnesota, and Nebraska, set single-day case records on Wednesday. Cases are also mounting in the Mountain West and even in the Northeast, which thought that COVID had come and gone. Stat News points out a downside of the increasingly available testing for COVID-19. We're losing critical data about the pandemic. Many tests are performed at sites that don't follow the specific data reporting processes. Thousands and thousands of testing sites nationwide are beginning to operate outside of lab facilities and aren't equipped to comply with state and federal reporting regulations, and that includes the vast majority of nursing homes. Even more data will be lost when rapid tests become available so that people can test themselves at home. And without data, public health strategies will be haphazard and ineffective. Now, I want to underscore that this is one case. It's an anecdote. But in an article published yesterday, researchers reported the case of a woman with leukemia who is still shedding infectious particles of SARS-CoV-2 70 days after her first positive test. Doctors detected, isolated, and tracked one woman's infection using diagnostic PCR tests and throat swabs. The 71-year-old woman has carried chronic lymphocytic leukemia, for over 10 years. She first tested positive for COVID on the 2nd of March after she was admitted to hospital for severe anemia that was linked to her cancer. And then she has tested positive for COVID-19 another 13 times and has yet to show symptoms of the disease. They think she picked up the virus at a rehab facility where she had spent some time in February. Now, Linda did something really interesting here, comparing two accounts of the same news story. And this is something I like to do occasionally because it shows, well, it shows what happens during the news gathering process. The story, first reported by Reuters here in a condensed article, riot police pepper sprayed students after they blockaded a Paris high school on Tuesday in a protest over inadequate COVID-19 sanitary measures. Several dozen students used wheelie bins, metal grills, and supermarket baskets to block access to the entrance of the Lycée Colbert in central Paris. During the morning, they hung a banner reading, "On Strike." Some students hurled colored liquid and glass projectiles when riot officers moved in using pepper spray and their shields to push the students back. "Our classes are packed with students sitting side by side," said a pupil at the school. "They've tried to rearrange the tables, but it changes nothing because there's still 30 of us in a class. They are demanding that class sizes be cut in half." In the final two lines of this Reuters report, a representative of the Lycée Colbert said the school was open in the afternoon. There were similar protests at several other schools in Paris. And President Emmanuel Macron ordered France back into lockdown last Friday, but he left schools open, unlike the first round in the spring. So then Linda, and by the way, I'm going to put up the links to both the Reuters article and this more expansive and detailed piece from the World Socialist website. And here is their version. Yesterday, French riot police tear gassed and broke up protests by high school students calling for the closure of their schools to prevent the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. Protests and blockades of school entrances were reported in over a dozen schools. They were organized the day after a wave of teacher strikes began Monday with the resumption of classes after a holiday break. Teachers at dozens of schools held local meetings shortly before 9 a.m. and voted not to enter classrooms under conditions where there were no protocols to realistically prevent the spread of the virus. Now, let me pause. Already, we've learned that this happened in a dozen schools, but Reuters limited it to a single school in Paris. All right. The WSWS report continues. In Paris, students held protests outside the Hélène Boucher, Maurice Ravel, Sophie Germain, and Colbert schools, blockading the entrances with bins. A large protest of 300 students blocked the entrance to the Aristide-Briand school in Saint-Nazaire. You love my French accent, don't you? 30 students protested outside Pasteur school in Besançon, and students picketed outside the gates of the Delon school in Bobigny, northeast of Paris. A quote from a student: "We are still just as crammed together in the corridors and stairways at 8 a.m. It's the same. We are still 36 in a class with all the windows closed." A student told journalist Charles Baudry, "We still have the same classes filled with students side by side. We are demanding the reduction of student numbers by half." And then there's a quote from another student, and this article continues. But already I think you have the clear idea that the Reuters story was not only brief, but it omitted key information about the scope of these student strikes in France. Meanwhile, across Europe, England began a four-week national lockdown today. Greece has announced new restrictions nationwide. We just talked about France, but their lockdown began on Thursday. Intensive care units in hospitals across the country are nearing full capacity. And the death rate is climbing. And I previously reported from some of our listeners who are skeptical about the pandemic and who believe there's been media hype, and there has been. But the death rate is climbing, and so this is not simply a so-called case-demic. A few other quick stories here before I go. Philadelphia police have released the body camera video of the police killing of Walter Wallace Jr., and the officers have finally been identified. They are Sean Matarazzo, age 25, and Thomas Munns, age 26. They each peppered 7 bullets into Wallace, who was a car length and a half away from them. He was carrying a knife, but it appeared he had no possibility of injuring the officers. And yet, with little preamble, each officer fired 7 shots and left Wallace dead. And I hope that the protests in Philly will remain peaceful, but I can certainly understand the outrage that people feel. There were some skirmishes on the streets of Portland, Oregon last night. There are actually 2 different protests, a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest and one that turned into some property damage, vandalism, 11 people arrested. And this was done by this combined force of the state troopers and the Oregon National Guard was called out. And part of the protest was that Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler was reelected to a second term on Tuesday. And there was also some protest in Seattle last night. About 7 people were arrested. 1 person arrested for a damaging property was taken to a hospital after some sort of a medical episode. In Minneapolis, police arrested more than 600 demonstrators who marched onto an interstate in Minneapolis, protesting Trump's threats to challenge the election results. No force or chemicals were used to make those arrests. And I'll just note that they picked up 600 people for blocking a freeway. But when Trump caravans did that this past weekend, all over the nation, I'm not aware of a single arrest. We also have protests that have broken out, some demanding that the vote count continue, some demanding that the vote count stop. But so far, we've not seen any serious violence related to the election. Oh, and here's a sad sack story. The guy who was the sacrificial lamb, chosen by Republicans in Washington state to take on Jay Inslee, who won a third term on Tuesday. The loser is a candidate named Lauren Culp. And his day job is that he is the police chief and only officer in the tiny town of Republic, Washington, located in Ferry County. So he lost the election, although he's not willing to concede yet. And then the city council in Republic decided to shut down the police department and eliminate his job. Yeah, defund the police. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You can share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. I don't know what'll come next, but I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.